communities where they've all participated in this type of activity. But my purpose of showing you that is that in this project, scenes play a major part, and they're called activity settings, and they are a unit of analysis that we work with, and they're fundamental to this case study approach that we're going to be doing. We do. So the project is called Using Digital Visual Methods in Cross-Cultural Research with Young Children, and it's funded by BA Leverhulme, and it's a methodological project. The idea really was to try and sort out the methodology before starting to really look into the substantive area. There's four of us participating in the project from four different countries. So there's Michelle from Education University of Hong Kong, there's Cecile from Tromsø, Norway, myself, and Rajni from Tata Institute of Mumbai. They've all come from slightly different disciplinary backgrounds. So Michelle's early childhood, Cecile is more special needs development, Rajni is a psychologist, and I'm an educationist and done loads of bits and bobs. So we've got, there is difference in our backgrounds, but we've all worked with visual methods in different ways, and we have an interest in that, which has brought us together. So in this project, we asked the question, how can we use visual technology critically to explicate learning as developing through interaction between young children and fathers in home environments from the child's perspective across four national contexts? So quite a lot going on there. The direction I want to take you in this talk is really just to get you to think about the potential of using visual technology in cross-cultural case studies, and particularly the potential of research with young children, its potential in terms of practical usefulness, because I'm a strong believer that research should be theoretically exciting and practically useful and increasingly methodologically sophisticated. But I think it also has potential in terms of scope with international teams. But I say it with a caveat, because I don't think that potential or the possibilities for it can be realised without building reflexivity into the research. And that's really into the research design. And that's where I come in terms of this project, because I think it has implications for the quality and the scope of the knowledge that we produce. So my plan is to talk to you a little bit about the research design, the problem theory and method and its coherence, some of the issues to do with visual technology. I would just today focus on visual analysis and points of comparison. And in the conclusion, I'll talk about, I'll give you some closing scenes, which I think present possibilities for scope in different areas. So, the research design. First of all, why visual technology for this problem that we're interested in? One of the things is that the literature, and I come from education, and the literature on young children says that the single most important determinant of a child's success is the influence of the home learning environment. So the home is key to a child's social, emotional, educational outcomes. And that's shown in work by Silver, but also Feinstein. For Feinstein, it's an issue of class. For Silver, it's not who you are, what you do, is the phrase that her team uses. But the point is, they all point to it comes from the home. When it comes to fathers, there's some quite interesting research that shows strong correlation work between father involvement and children's social, emotional and educational outcomes, even when they're controlling for mother involvement. But it's correlation work. So we don't actually know how they interact in terms of learning. And I think it's not an easy area to probe, because it's the private area of the home. And getting to the child's perspective is not easy for those of you who've worked with young children. But we did think that visual methods might be a way forward. A, because you don't necessarily have to be in the house with the family all the time. Children are very familiar with visual technologies. And there's quite a lot of work that's been done with young children where they've used a whole range of visual technologies, whether it's cameras, mobile phones. It's also got that potential for a more equitable relationship because the child, in principle, has the power to choose what they want to film, for example. So it's more collaborative in terms of participatory approaches. Buckingham wrote a really interesting article in 2009. I don't know if anybody's read it. He's quite critical of Gauntlet, I think, in that one. But he talks about visual methods and that have been used in education, but have not been used critically. And that's where I picked up on this, and I thought, okay. So what we need to do is start thinking about how we can take these methods and think about what we're producing as knowledge, but think about it critically. So that's why we came up with this idea to start looking at using visual technology in the home environment with young children. So our aim is really to try and make explicit how fathers engage in child development in the home from the child's perspective, and it's in four national contexts. And specifically, we look at how the children represent paternal engagement. So the choices they make, if you like, but how they make those choices as well, so the process of production. And we look at the cultural differences in their representation. And when I talk about culture, I'm talking about at the institutional level and the culture of the home environment. That's what we're really interested in. And the intention is to develop a cross-cultural methodology to look at children's relationships in home environments across national contexts. When I talk about visual technology and using it, it could be a range of possibilities. It's not about a research approach. It's about saying, well, what possibilities do these sources of data have for extending our the final product, if you like, the ethnographic portrait that we provide, or the visual portrait. Theoretically, because we're thinking about young children's learning development, we're thinking about the kind of knowledge we're producing from the visual, and we're thinking about cross-cultural work, there are quite a few positions we have to take in terms of theoretical and epistemological positions. So our theoretical framework is really linked to these three areas: oppositional learning and development, how do we see the visual in terms of the kind of knowledge it produces, where do we stand, and what kinds of questions do we ask if we're producing cross-cultural case studies. So in terms of development, we don't come from a model of development that's maturational or that sees cognition in terms of domains. We come from a more Vygotskian or cultural historical perspective of development, where development really, learning and development, is about change. And it's focusing on more on the development of consciousness and personality rather than thinking in terms of domains. And because of the way they define development, there are methods that are probably more suitable for capturing that change or moments of change. Concepts of intention or motive, the social situation of the child, and the dynamics of change can be captured through using visual methods, particularly visual technology. So the work by Fleer and Ridgway is quite interesting if anybody's interested in that area, to capture that that process. So that's our position on development. This is the larger model that we work with and adapt. And this is from Hedegaard. And you can see, and one of the things that the concepts that we work with is activity settings, as I said. And you can see here that there is, we're looking at the family as an institution. In Hedegaard's and Fleer's original model, there are different institutions there. So there might be family, there might be nursery, and they look at the transition that a child makes when they go from one to the other. We're just focusing on the family, family as an institution. There are key concepts that we work with when we're working with that model. As I said, activity settings. And what I like about this concept of activity setting is that, you know, in sociology, we talk about context. In education, we talk about context. But defining context is really not an easy task. It's a word that's bandied about, but not easily explicated. What I like about the term activity setting is that it actually acknowledges that we can't separate our participation from whatever we're participating in. And so that whole context has to be taken account of, that scene, if you like, not one aspect, but the whole thing. So the social material conditions, the expectations, the demands on the child and what the child wants from that situation. The other concept that we use is the social situation of the child, and this Glendon has conceptualised it here. It's a key concept that conceptualises the environment of which a child is part, and it's the social material conditions alongside what is called the child's predicament. It's based on the idea that we become who we are through our participation in everyday life. And so when we start to look at a situation that a child is in, we need to look at the social and material conditions that is in that situation, and what's demanded of that child and what that child wants as well. So that's our conceptual concepts to do with and where we stand with this concept of development. What about the visual, though? Well, Pink writes extensively about visual ethnography, and I think her work's quite helpful because she starts to give an understanding of the positions, the ontological positions, and the kinds of knowledge those ontological positions produce. So she talks in terms of the scientific realist and the reflexive. And the scientific realist, as you see, it has a notion of objectivity. It's quite often the visual might be used to support the written. Whereas the other end of the continuum, if you like, is more of a concept of reflexivity, where it's not just the final product that matters, but the process of getting to that product. How is that product produced? It's about producing another way of knowing as well. So, for example, I was in one project where a child was wearing a GoPro, and I was looking at the footage of them running around in the woods, playing with their dad, cycling, and my understanding of the knowing, shall I say, I gained from watching that footage was sensory. And I think Jennifer Mason talks about sensory knowledge. So it's a different way of knowing. You know, I felt dizzy. I felt a pace of running that I didn't even envisage. So the whole experience of being a young person was very different, and my understanding of it was different. It was another way of knowing, and that was through that that reflexive approach, really, This is the approach that we use. We start to say, okay, let's look at how they engage with the visual. But I'm not. When we talk about being reflexive, sometimes people mistake it for reflection, I think, when I talk to some people. And I just want to be clear that, that's not what I'm talking about here. Paul gives a very interesting explanation of it. He says we need to go beyond the source of data to look at the ways the researcher works with the source and the data it might yield. Similarly, Pink talks about, you know, if you're going to look at the knowledge that's produced, well, look at the process that gets there between the researcher, the subject of the whatever you're watching, the footage, and the technology. For me, the easiest way I think I approach it is I go back to my field work and this whole concept of reflexivity that I've always used, and that I ask myself, how are my characteristics influencing how this person is seeing me, and in turn giving me the kinds of data that that's being yielded. So what's influencing this person about me that's giving me the information? So I start to take that and say, okay, well, if I look at the visual, whether it's a piece of equipment or footage, how does that child see that piece of equipment, and how does it in turn influence the way she presents herself to me? So if that child sees it as a way of making her look like a film star, then that will influence the kind of data that she gives me. And I apply the same idea to the footage. Finally, cross-cultural case study. And I turn to the work of Burgess and Broadfoot, who've done some extended work, particularly in higher education, I think Burgess's work was, in defining what we mean by cross-cultural case study. Not with the visual, but just cross-cultural. And he raises some interesting questions that I think can be built on when we're thinking about the visual. So what are the boundaries of the case? What's the unit of analysis? How are you selecting your comparisons? What's the basis for that selection? How are you defining the link between your contemporary phenomena and history? Is there a link there? If you've got multiple cases, what are they and how are they being compared? If you've got multiple sites, what's being compared? And are there problems that you're having that affect how you can compare? And with Broadfoot's work, she raises the issue of language and how do you construct a mutual understanding if you've got different languages. And these are all really, really relevant questions that we had to think about and are still thinking about and discussing as we analyse the data. But they're important if we're going to call this a cross-cultural case study. And it is a study where it is multi-site as well as multi-case. And that raises a whole number of questions in terms of how are you comparing things and why and for what purpose, which is interesting in terms of our work. So the case is really learning is developing through interaction between father and child in home environments. That's what we're really interested in. But it's a multi-case study, so you've got cases within a case. So you have three families that we work with in England. We have three families that we work with in Hong Kong, three families that we work with in India, in Mumbai, and three families that we work with in Norway. So they are sort of multi-case within the case, cases within the case. And the multi-site is the four different sites, Norway, Hong Kong, England, and India. As for the sampling, originally we started off with theoretical sampling. So within the case, we have actually, we stuck with the idea of working with middle class fathers on the basis that the literature had talked about them having more autonomy. We also wanted to reduce the number of variables that we were working with at the moment, just so that we could focus on the methodology more. So, and on the basis that in the literature, there's so much variation between the middle class anyway. So getting at that variation, we thought would be interesting. We've kept the variables down to a minimum, so two parents, heterogeneous couples at this stage. And one of the interesting things we built in was also age-related sibling structures. So we've got children who haven't started school yet, and a sibling who's just started school. And the reason we did that was in the 80s, Fiennes Sandstrom wrote a book about knowing children, and they talk about a young child at one end of the continuum and an adult at the other end of the continuum, and being totally unknown to each other in terms of their worlds. So we thought, well, what about if we have somebody, a child who is close to that end of the spectrum, but can also is familiar with how to communicate with an adult because they've started school. So on that basis, we thought, okay, let's try sibling structures here. And that's been very interesting, actually, using sibling structures in many different ways, particularly as mediators in different elements of the research process. And within SITE, we've got four countries, so it's multi-SITE, so we've got, as I said, four countries. And they're different in terms of their policies, their values, their understandings of the role of men. So you've got Norway at one end of the spectrum, where they've got a strong policy on father involvement and parental leave, and India on the other end of the spectrum, which, you know, despite having increased women into the labour force and migration to more away from extended families because of work, still has only just started a maternity leave policy, I think. So you know, a complete contrast, if you like. Data collection methods. We've got five data sets, but I'm going to only talk about two of them today. We have children, child-generated footage. It was planned for the children to collect footage of their everyday activities with their fathers, up to 10 everyday routines that they did with their fathers, and they had to do this over a period of 2 weeks in two different stages. They had a range of technologies to work with, and they could choose, having done the training session. And we've called that child stroke participant generated footage. It should be the other way around. Originally it was child generated, but there were some issues in data collection about the reliability of the footage. Some of it was quite wobbly, so it's a technical competence issue, but that had its impact in terms of how we collected the data, the footage rather. There's telephone interviews with the fathers just a few days after we've give them all the equipment, so we can get some feedback on the technical issues and try and iron them out. And then we have film elicitation interviews, so the children watch the footage that they've taken and talk to us about it. And that's where the research-generated footage comes in. And that's the interesting part of this project for me, because that's when you film them watching the footage of themselves. And that's what allows us to be reflexive. And there are face-to-face interviews with fathers which help us to understand what is informing the interactions in the home at the institutional level in terms of societal values, or perhaps from his own biography as well, so we can start to link it to wider issues in their lives. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about some of the issues to do with data analysis, I think. So, as I said, activity settings, the scenes, and the child's perspective in relation to the social situation they're in, or the conditions of development, is really a prerequisite for examining the different kinds of instructional relationships that go on in the family. So we need to know what the child's perspective is before we can start to look at the learning that's going on in that situation. And Hedegaard talks about, you know, how we can start to think about comparing those conditions for development, social situation of a child. And she asked questions that, which I've adapted for our purpose. What activity settings between father and child dominate the institutional practices in each family? So what are the main things that they do together, really? What does the father expect from the child in those practices? How does the child act in the activity settings? And what kinds of conflict occurs? Because it's through the conflict that we can start to see where change happens. It's the struggle for change that allows us to see where learning can potentially occur. And these are our examples of the participant child-generated footage, the activity settings. So you can see eating together, playing games, and I've just picked them out from the different families. Bedtime stories, being cared for. And what we start to do once we've got an indication, this is probably too small, oh no, it's not actually not too bad. What we start to do when we've got an indication of the different activity settings is to look at them in relation to each family, because we need to start to compare within family, within the case, one family at a time, even though the case will be the three. But what are the activity settings? How can we start to characterise the instructional relationships? And you can see here, this family, this is all in England, so we've got meal times, doing homework at meal times. It's very common in England, in the three families, which were a cluster sample, mind, to be doing homework at the dining table. The school really entered the home, and I didn't see that at all in places in Norway. But I mean, the point is that it seemed to be a pattern across these three families. But so we then start to get an idea. Okay, this is what these are the kinds of things Dad does with the children, and then later on, when we start to characterise the instructional relationship, we map. The control element in the pedagogic communication on it. So I bring in Bernstein then, which I'm not going to talk about today, but that's why you see that regulatory context. So you might see father having more of a dialogic relationship at bedtime, and the framing is weak for those of you familiar with Bernstein. Whereas at meal times, you might have quite a strong framing, and the instructional relationship will be totally different. So we start to see. So when we're accessing the child's perspective, we start to look at the conflicts, because that's the easiest way to recognise a shift, a change in how they're approaching a situation. So basically we start to look at situations where Dad wants something and the child wants something and how it's resolved. That's the easiest way, I think. And in that, through understanding that situation, you can actually work out what the child's intention is, as long as you describe the social conditions and the expectations within it. And what we do is, so when we do this, we then get them to watch it. So the participant-generated footage is sampled for these conflict situations. We also take emotionally charged footage as well, because that's an indication of potential change anyway. And we ask them to watch it. What we're looking for is trying to understand the social situation of the child. But we ask them to watch it, and we ask ourselves, when the children watch the footage of their representations, how do they respond, both verbally and physically, to the subject of the images? And how does that response influence our understanding of their social situation of development? So what factors? So that's where the reflexivity comes in. So this is an example.
Now,
how's it going?
Dinner.
Okay, and then we ask them to watch these examples.
This one is just at the beginning, actually.
She asked, don't you hear what I said there in the
beginning? No, because I can't understand what you say. I can see your body. And I can see you're trying to explain something and you don't agree with that. But I don't know why. So then how did the problem get solved?
She agrees with me.
So how did you handle the situation then?
I tried to explain that it wasn't all right to decide rules into a game. The rules were set before we started the games.
Now, what we do is we analyse their responses, okay? And in this situation, she didn't give much of a verbal response. She gave a physical response. She was really interested. And in some cases, you can't get their attention with little ones, so you have to then think, okay, what's going on here? But what her lack of verbal response did was elicit the father to give it a wider perspective. And so with some of them who don't say much, you have to look for what else is going on in that situation. And in this situation, you start to get multiple perspectives. And what we find out as the conversation continues is that she tries to negotiate with her father, but for what her father wants is for her to understand that being fair is what matters. It's more of a moral, a regulative issue he wants her to learn. And so it's about moral conduct. And what we do then is say, okay, let's have a look in other activity settings in these interactions. And does he have this sort of approach with other things that they talk about? Is it the same sort of motive, or do other motives come up? And then what the development possibilities are. So I'm going to stop there. I'm just going to say that in this situation, it was the issue was she couldn't. She didn't verbalise what she was saying, so there was the father's perspective came in more strongly. But there are other situations where you can't, with the young children, you can't keep their attention. So the question then is, if you can't keep their attention, how are you going to get the data to compare? And then we start looking at footage to say, okay, there have been footages where, there's footage where we do get their attention for a while, and then it goes, can't sustain it, or we can't get it in the first place. Or if we have, how have we done it? And what comes through with the attention issue is that actually emotional dialogue seems to be recognising the non-verbal cues that children give you, and developing that emotional dialogue starts to get them more attuned so that then they then start to participate more and engage. Because until you can get to that point, you can't actually do the comparisons. The other issue is, with young children, is their confidence as well. And that's where the siblings come in very useful, because when we look at how the sibling responds, so the older sibling might respond, and they will watch the older sibling, when we look at, and they'll start to understand how to respond to this situation. They may disagree with the older sibling, which brings a volition, if you like, in some cases, because some siblings do argue. So we have had situations where the older sibling is a really useful mediator in terms of either helping the child to understand how to respond verbally to this interview setting, or helping the child to show the volition because they don't agree with what's going on. And it's almost like a second stimulus, the first stimulus being the film, and then they watch happens as the sibling responds to the film, and that acts as a second stimulus for them to then respond. So I'm going to end there, actually.
Okay.
Just to have been too many slides. What I will say is that I've used reflexivity in what I've described, and reflexivity. The visual technology by its very nature is a reflexive device, and so it is possible to use it collaboratively for comparison in a number of ways. I've just talked about working with children, but I've also shown it to practitioners, the footage to practitioners, and that gives me an indication of what they value, and that has potential, I think, for interventionist work. We've also used it in the teams as well, where we film each other on when we do the conference Skypes and we're having discussions. And again, we start to see how we're responding to each other, and whether it's one of negotiation, this is my position, or whether we move to working as a collaborative team.
Thank you very much.